Ukrainian officials are warning thousands of people in the eastern city of Severodonetsk they will soon face awful conditions with no water, gas, or electricity. This as Russia steps up attacks in eastern Ukraine. Meantime, weapons from the U.S. and other allies of Kyiv have started to work very powerfully, according to Ukrainian President Zelensky. This war is now in month 5 and sending global shocks because Russia controls a quarter of Ukrainian farmland, stoking a food crisis in the country and in global food markets. Ukraine's Deputy Economic Minister Taras Kachka told Al Jazeera that this is part of the Russian strategy.
What Russia is doing is blocking our seaports, stealing our grain, trying to impose its will on Turkey and other states. And this is just what they do intentionally, is creating a mess.
Let's bring in Shashank Joshi, defense editor at The Economist. Hello.
Hello. Thank you very much for having me.
So first to the battlefront. Russian forces have consolidated control over most or all of the Luhansk region in the east, and they're now expected to attack in the Donetsk region next door, specifically the city of Sloviansk. How critical a moment is this, you know, 4 months plus into this war?
Well, the stated Russian aim was to liberate Donbass, which is made up of the two provinces you describe, Luhansk, which they now control, and Donetsk, which they don't, in large part. And so, ultimately, the moment we're at will determine whether this is a Russian army that has run out of steam, what we call in military terms culminating, the point of culmination, and whether it will essentially grind to a halt as it did in the outskirts of Kyiv back in March, or whether it's an army that will use the momentum it has gained from Severodonetsk and the seizure of the twin town of Lysychansk and push west and be able to take those big urban areas, Sloviansk and the neighboring city of Kramatorsk, which is a major industrial center. It will really show us, I think, in the next week, really, whether the Russian army has the momentum to do that, or whether this is an inflection point in the campaign in which both sides will pause, reset, and Ukraine will then prepare for a counteroffensive.
Speaking of momentum, as far as Ukraine and its supporters, you and your colleagues at The Economist write, Ukraine is counting on its Western allies. Vladimir Putin is counting on them to lose heart. So as far as these allies of Ukraine, the US, the UK, NATO, are they losing heart?
Well, at the moment, absolutely not. The opposite. They're intensifying their support. We're seeing more advanced weapons go into Ukraine, particularly rocket launchers like the U.S. High Mobility Artillery Rocket System, the HIMARS launcher we've been hearing about. And we're seeing training efforts from the U.K. and others. We saw a very strong common front at the G7 summit and the NATO summit in June in Bavaria and in Madrid, respectively. So we're seeing overall a strong degree of cohesion among Western partners. I think the risk, Scott, is what happens down the line. What happens when this war drags on through the autumn into the winter, when gas prices and energy prices in Europe begin to rise, the cost of living bites, inflation is an issue in Europe and in the United States, in which weapon supplies become harder to scrape together for Ukraine, because, of course, we also have our own constraints on ammunition in Europe and in other places. That's when I think we will be tested. And that's a political call. You know, it's impossible to say in advance. It depends on many political factors, such as changes in leadership. We have one here in the UK, of course, as I speak. It depends on the midterm elections in the United States and the shadow cast by populist movements in other parts of Europe. It will depend on the politics, because if Ukraine has a continued flow of weapons, it can stay in this fight. If it doesn't, then it probably can't.
Will this war, you think, go on through the winter?
I think it probably will. Ukraine hopes to mount a counteroffensive to take back some land, probably in southern Kherson province, which is a bit of the battlefield we haven't heard as much about, but it's in the south rather than the east, like Donbass. They've mounted some counterattacks in the last few months. They want to do a bigger one, some people say perhaps in the late summer, some people say in the autumn. But I think that that's not going to settle the issue. Russia's not going to give up. I think Russia's aim remains to subjugate Ukraine as a state, including to subjugate Kyiv. And Ukraine isn't going to, I think, agree to a settlement that sees it lose the 20% of territory that Russia is currently occupying. Therefore, in one form or another, this will drag on into next year. The intensity of fighting may go down because both sides will have to ration their ammunition and artillery consumption. Weapons flows may be difficult to keep up at this rate. But I don't see a negotiated settlement, and I don't see a decisive victory for either side. And therefore, I think that this is going to limp on.
And as this war drags on, we know it is upending grain exports and markets in the world. There are reports of a looming food crisis in Ukraine. And chillingly, the head of NASA's harvest program said, "We are in the beginning stages of a rolling food crisis that will likely affect every country and person on Earth in some way." How concerning is that?
It's hugely concerning. Of course, Ukraine is a breadbasket, and exports from its ports have been jammed up largely because of a Russian de facto blockade in the Black Sea. There are efforts underway, including by countries such as Turkey, to try and facilitate grain shipments out of Ukrainian ports, essentially to open up that blockade of particularly of Odessa, the port city, Ukraine's main avenue to the rest of the world. But in many ways, we have to understand this isn't a bug in Russian policy. It's a feature of Russian policy. Their approach is to say this global food crisis, this famine, is not our fault. It's a fault of Western sanctions that are stopping Ukraine from exporting these things and stopping our grain from getting out. Now, that's not true. But a lot of people in what you might call the global south, in India, in South Africa, in Brazil, in a lot of non-aligned countries or countries that are not in the Western camp, believe that. And the Russians think the longer that pain goes on, the more suffering there is. In some ways, it benefits their narrative that the West has to lift sanctions on Russia and this problem would go away. So in many ways, the important thing to understand is this isn't just a kind of technical problem. This is part of the Russian strategy, and it's not going to be easily resolved. And there's no simple military solution because, you know, running that blockade, forcing it open using military vessels is legally impossible because Turkey controls the Bosphorus Straits under the Montreux Convention. And it's militarily very challenging because you would have to risk being struck by Russian vessels. So I don't see any country really willing to run those risks.
And finally, if I can just return to this question of endgame in this war and how these two sides get there. Longer run, how does this play out? I mean, you're describing these two sides that do not seem to be talking to each other as far as how this ends.
The general sense is that it will have to end with the settlement, as Volodymyr Zelensky has said that himself, and that's how most wars end. The aim of Western policy, as Joe Biden or other leaders will tell you quite openly, is to say they are trying to put Ukraine in the best possible position for those negotiations whenever it is ready to do that. And no one wants to dictate to Ukraine when that should be. But I think the sense is one side or other is going to become exhausted in the way that Russia became exhausted, trying to invade Kiev from the north, getting bogged down, suffering enormous losses. It got exhausted. It gave up. It went home and then attacked a different part of Ukraine, focusing on the east. The hope is that Ukraine, by targeting Russian rear areas, particularly things like ammunition depots with its new weapons, its new longer-range Western weapons, it can disrupt Russia's offensive and it can make it unsustainable and prohibitively costly for Russia to the point where the Kremlin backs down. Now, of course, the risk is Russia believes that it can target Ukrainian cities, infrastructure, railway hubs, grain terminals with missiles and airstrikes, and that Ukraine will become exhausted and its Western partners will become exhausted. What we are in is in a war of attrition. And in wars of attrition, it's not that one side breaks through, seizes a capital and plants a flag up somewhere. It's about exhaustion. It's about stomach. It's about resolve. It's about grit. How much of it you have, how much you have left. So I think that, you know, we don't know when this will end. In some ways, this war has already gone on since 2014 when Russia first invaded Donbass during the crisis. And it wouldn't surprise me if years later we are still looking at something more akin to a kind of Korean armistice line, a sort of line of control with occasional shelling, like, or the India-Pakistan line, than we are to some kind of durable end to this war in the clinical, clean, satisfying way one might expect.
Wow. Years from now. Shashank Joshi is defense editor of The Economist. Shashank, thanks so much for the time.
You're very welcome.